In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with investigative reporter James Bamford. He's written a lot about American intelligence gathering and is known for a couple of books that he has done about the National Security Agency, Body of Secrets and the Puzzle Palace, those books. And when he wrote them, particularly the earlier book, very little had been written about the NSA. It was one of the most secret of all of our intelligence gathering agencies. And he was really the first reporter and one of the few who's written extensively about the NSA. He has also written on national security issues for other publications, including the New York Times Magazine, the Washington Post Magazine, and the LA Times Magazine. Before that, he was Washington investigative producer for ABC's World News Tonight, and he is a distinguished visiting professor at University of California, Berkeley. Right now, he's making his home in Washington, and we will talk in this part of the show about his new book, which looks at America and terrorism, how it is the United States performed, how the government performed on the day of the terrorist attacks, September 11th, about our failure to anticipate those attacks, and also about the way that intelligence was used, perhaps misused, to justify the war in Iraq. The book is titled A Pretext for War. It's published by Doubleday. It's just out now, just recently out. And as we talk this morning with James Bamford, we certainly welcome questions. I expect we'll have a lot of them, and callers can help us by being brief and making room for others. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. 800-222-9455. That's the number. That's the toll-free, 800-222-9455, and locally, 333-9455. Mr. Bamford, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks, and thanks very much for talking with us again.
Oh, my pleasure.
As I mentioned here, the book has this three major sections. It looks at what happened, how the government responded specifically on that day. It also looked at the failure to anticipate the attacks. And then the third section is about Iraq. And I expect probably we want to concentrate maybe mainly on two and three, but I just do want to ask you a couple of questions about that first about that first section. Once it was known that some planes had been hijacked, and particularly after the very first plane hit that first tower of the Trade Center, could anything have been done at that point to stop the other planes?
Well, had everything been in the right place at the right time with a lot of preparation, it's possible, yeah. But the problem was there was total chaos that was going on at that point. At that moment, there were only 14 jet fighters protecting the entire continental United States. From seven different bases. And ironically, the two bases closest to the two most, the largest and the most important city, Washington, D.C. and New York City, were some 200 miles away from each of those. So even though they were alerted, they never were able to intercept the aircraft in time. And ironically, according to the hearings this morning, the pilots who took off and their fighters from Langley Air Force Base, which is down in Virginia, around the Norfolk area, when they were flying up to Washington, they didn't even know what their mission was. They thought that it was some cruise missile from the Atlantic that they were looking for. So nobody even told them what the object of their mission to Washington was.
Yeah. Well, that's another thing that's really striking as you write in this section of the book is how slowly the news about the attacks came to be known by people in government. Not only are we talking about the White House, but members of Congress and also people at CIA and NSA. And also striking is that in some cases, people, when they heard the news, just went on with what they were doing.
That's right. It was quite amazing. I mean, nothing like this had ever happened before, and Washington was caught totally unprepared and went into almost an instant state of chaos. For example, the president himself, he was sitting in a classroom in Florida, and he was told about the second plane crash, but told by his chief of staff that the country is under attack. And yet, for 7 minutes, he continued just to sit there in a little chair in a second grade class, and it was really astounding to a lot of people, especially among the victims, that the relatives of the victims, that the president can actually just sit there for 7 full minutes while the country was under attack. He never once called for where is the Secretary of Defense, or what's the status of NATO, or what are we doing to prevent this, or get me Condoleezza Rice on the phone. And it seemed like he was just dazed for 7 full minutes, and then he slowly reacted after that. In Congress, it was a similar incident. There was no alert through Congress. So some people sat at their desks while other people ran out into the sidewalks, and eventually it looked like one of the planes was going to be heading for the Capitol, and then the Capitol was evacuated, and you had senators and congressmen that were just wandering around the streets, not knowing where to go. Eventually, they were taken up to the top floor of the Capitol Police Office. They have a sort of a decrepit building down near the Capitol, and they were all taken up, the ones they could round up, they were taken up to the top floor of the building. And the only thing they could do defensively was just pull down the shades. So it was rather ineffective. And then later on, several of the senior members of Congress were taken to one of the secret locations, a place called Mount Weather, which was about 20 minutes by helicopter south of Washington. Ironically, there was a place for Congress to be evacuated to outside of Washington. It was a very large sort of secret location underneath the Greenbrier Hotel in West Virginia. But that location had been discovered by the press early in the 90s, and by 2001 it had simply become a tourist attraction. So Congress was basically without a place to go.
Yeah. It seems just one further point here that what, again, is what's striking about the way the government responded is once the response... There was a response. What they did was they activated the system that had been designed for that day, if and when the United States would be attacked by the Soviet Union. So in other words, they responded to the attack as if it was World War III, which, maybe it would have been difficult to know exactly what was going on at the time, but at least you would think that there would have been some awareness that the Cold War was over and probably this was not World War III, but maybe the issue is that there was no other system in place to activate, so they went with the one that they had.
Well, that's exactly what they did. There was only one thing left in terms of a emergency, and that was this contingency in government plan. And it had never been enacted in full like it was on September 11th, and it was the first time the U.S. had ever gone to virtually full alert, the type of alert you would go to in a nuclear war. It was the very first time the country had ever gone to that level of pre-nuclear attack alert. And the president was flown to Omaha, Nebraska, where he was brought down to an emergency command center where a nuclear war would be fought from. The vice president was in the bunker at the White House, a bomb-proof bunker. There were all the steps that were taken were the type of steps that would have been taken if we were about to go to a nuclear war. The president's emergency airborne command post was put on alert and put into the air, a thing called Night Watch. It's rather amazing that once all that scenario was played out, the question was, well, who do we attack once we're all set to attack? And that was the question. We had the whole contingency and government plan in operation, and yet nobody knew who to attack if we were going to attack anybody.
Mm. The administration continues to state that Al-Qaeda and terrorism generally is still a threat, and that there is the very real possibility that there could be another terrorist attack somewhere inside the United States. Of course, we don't know where or when, but they say that we should not assume that it could never happen again. If it did happen again, if it happened tomorrow, would the government response, do you think, be any better than it was on September 11th of 2001?
Well, you hope so, but the problem is you never really know until an event like that happens. But they have certainly corrected a number of the problems. Now there's many more planes than 17 planes available in case of an attack. They are focused now looking inward as well as outward. There's a linkage between the NORAD and domestic airline flights, and so there's a lot of other factors that are in place now that weren't in place before, and those factors presumably would help prevent a similar type of attack. But the problem is that Al-Qaeda usually learns also from past experience, and so the next time they attack probably won't be in the same way. It'll be in a different way. So the real question is whether we're prepared in other ways that Al-Qaeda might want to attack.
I have a couple of callers here, and I promise them I'll get right to them in just a second. Let me just, though, ask one big question, and certainly we can get into more detail. And that has to do with is by anybody's standards a spectacular failure of intelligence, and that is the failure to anticipate the attacks of 9/11. Since that time, a lot of people have asked the question, could they have been prevented? Congress has asked, journalists have asked, academics have asked. Now we have the 9/11 Commission looking at much the same question. Now you're having the opportunity to think about this and talk to a lot of people and research it. Do you have an answer to that question? Could the attacks have been prevented?
Well, I think it's impossible to give you anybody to give a concrete answer to that. I think the real answer to the question is could much more have been done that could have led to possibly discovering the plot and so forth. And I think the answer to that is agreement by almost everybody that's looked at this. For one thing, the CIA was very was approaching the whole issue of Al-Qaeda in a very strange way. They were using only one technique, and that's covert operations. They were trying to get the Pakistani intelligence service to help get bin Laden. They hired a group of ex anti-Soviet Mujahideen in Afghanistan to try to track him and find out where he was going and so forth. And then they were sending a lot of money and weapons up to Ahmed Massoud up in the northern part of Afghanistan, who was in charge of a group called the Northern Alliance. He only controlled 10% of the country, but they were sending a lot of money and weapons his way in order to see if he could retake Afghanistan, and then they would be able to get bin Laden back. So they had all these sort of crazy schemes in order to try to get bin Laden. But the one thing they never did do was ever try to infiltrate Al-Qaeda. The CIA kept saying it was too hard, too difficult, too dangerous. We just wouldn't be able to penetrate Al-Qaeda, which was a very big mistake because it wasn't really that hard and it wasn't really that dangerous. And an example of that was that same summer of 2001, when the CIA was saying we can't possibly penetrate Al-Qaeda. Eight Americans, including John Walker Lynn, had actually not only penetrated Al-Qaeda, there were at that moment all together eight Americans, eight native-born Americans were actually in bin Laden's training camp, and they were having one-on-one meetings with bin Laden. They were learning bits and pieces of the plot. They weren't even trying to, but they were picking up bits and pieces of the plot and so forth. So, you know, if you can get eight Americans who, without a lot of difficulty, managed to get into bin Laden's training camp and have one-on-one meetings with bin Laden, and that the CIA not only didn't get in there, they didn't even try to get in there, I think that's outrageous. So there were a lot of things. That's one of the key things that the CIA could have done. Another thing was the CIA completely lost track of the two of the key leaders in the Al-Qaeda terrorist 911 attack. They were they followed them all the way to Kuala Lumpur, and then they completely lost track of them. And at that point, they flew to the United States. And what makes the situation even worse was at the time they found out that those two people had U.S. visas. So obviously they were going to fly to the United States, yet the CIA never passed that information on to the FBI for a year and a half until the August before the September attacks. And by then it was way too late. So there were numerous things that if you look at this these events, as I write about in my book, that could have pushed the CIA or the FBI into a direction where they could have maybe picked up bits and pieces of the plot and maybe have disrupted it or prevented it or whatever. We'll never know that, but we will know that they certainly could have done a lot better job than they did.
In this hour of Focus 580, we're talking with investigative reporter James Bamford. His new book is titled A Pretext for War, 9/11, Iraq, and the Abuse of America's Intelligence Agencies, that takes a look at how the American government responded to the terrorist attacks of 9/11, failures to have any kind of warning that the attacks were going to take place, and also looks at the way that intelligence was used to make the case for the Iraq War. The book is published by Doubleday, and we have callers and would welcome others. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, toll free 800-222-9455. And we'll start in here. We have a caller first in line in Champaign and on line one.
Hello. A lot of depressive things have come out since 9/11. I guess they were already there, that seem to be pointing to the demise of our democracy. And perhaps this attack is going to lead to our undoing, given our reaction to it or the administration that was in power when it happened. It seems like the project for a new American century was just waiting for something that they could compare to Pearl Harbor. You know, I guess we just haven't really been aware of what's going on at the Pentagon because, of course, it's a huge secret budget and everything's classified, but it seems like the military-industrial complex, along with the government, it's now an excuse for a fascist empire. But anyway, perhaps that sounds like an exaggeration. But I'm just wondering your reaction to that, and I also want to ask about. I mean, before the war began, Al Qaeda put out some kind of a statement. Osama bin Laden did, and I remember that it seemed to be saying we don't support Saddam Hussein. And then we hear the secretary, what's his name?
Secretary
not
of State?
The defense, the other one.
Mr. Powell?
Mr. Powell, yes, trying to interpret that for us, in which he's totally turning it around and saying this means that Al-Qaeda is with Saddam Hussein. I mean, if you listen to what's said, he's, no, I'm not for this secular leader. It seems as if Al-Qaeda really would just as soon have taken out Saddam Hussein as the Bush family, and we did it for them, and now they're cleaning up. I mean, the relations between those who oppose the Saudi government with those in Iraq who oppose Saddam Hussein appear to me to be pretty close, but we seem to have been completely in the dark about that.
Well, I agree with a lot of what you said, and particularly the sort of fascist turn that's taking place when you deny American citizens any right to legal counsel, which is being done by a couple of people that were arrested, Padilla and the other person that was arrested and kept in prison without any right to counsel whatsoever. It's going up before the Supreme Court now, but that gets pretty close to fascism. And I think the arguments in favor of that are extremely weak. The fact that they are involved in an ongoing war or whatever. There's been plenty of times when we've brought people to court for terrorism and tried them and convicted them. From the Oklahoma bombing people to many other incidents of terror. So there's no question that you can take them to court, prosecute him and put him in jail or whatever you want to do. But this administration takes the opposite viewpoint and seems to fly in the face of the Constitution. So I'm very worried about that also. In regard to the Pentagon, the people who are running the Pentagon are the people who have been pushing this war from the very beginning. And the it's somewhat frightening because these people have been pushing this war from the very beginning. They've actually been pushing it since 1996. In 1996, these same people who were basically the architects of this war at the Pentagon got together and decided to become consultants to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel. And they drafted a plan. It was called A Clean Break. And that plan was basically to have a Middle East war, for Israel to launch a Middle East war in which they overthrow Saddam Hussein and replace him with a puppet that was friendly to both the United States and Israel. And at the time, the person they had in mind was Ahmed Chalabi, who was sort of a darling of the neoconservative movement for a very long time, and the person sort of designated to take over Iraq after Saddam Hussein. And one of the key points that endeared him to this group was the fact that he was going to recognize Israel as one of his first moves upon taking over the country. So they had, this is Douglas Fife, who's currently the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, one of the top officials in the Pentagon, the number three official and one of the key architects of the war. Richard Perle, who was head of the Defense Policy Board, who had an extremely powerful position directing Pentagon policy. And David Wumser, who's currently the Vice President's Middle East advisors. They were all part of this group that made this plan. And Wumser, in January 2001, wrote a paper in which he, one of the things he said in there was, crises are opportunities. And that apparently is what happened. Netanyahu rejected this war plan. It sat on the shelf for many years. 9-1-1 came along, and that was the crisis that led to an opportunity, and the opportunity was to do the plan they had planned years earlier, overthrow Saddam Hussein and replace him with a puppet who was favorable to the United States and Israel. So that's sort of the genesis of the thinking that went into this war, and you know, I think it's an enormous conflict of interest when you have people who have been planning this for years and then use an opportunity in order to implement it.
Do you think there was any possibility of neglect in terms of national security to have this event happen in order to use it? I mean,
I
wouldn't have dared say that 2 years ago.
I'm sorry?
I wouldn't have dared even contemplate that 2 years ago.
Well, even today it's difficult to contemplate that people can, for ideological reasons, want to get rid of some country, declare war on a country, and then use an excuse, a pretext to carry that out. But that's just what happened. They used the pretext of weapons of mass destruction, which there was never any evidence that Iraq currently had these massive weapons of mass destruction. This is all fraud that was coming from defectors, mainly provided by Ahmed Chalabi again. He was the person who wanted to be the president of Iraq, and he kept supplying all this phony information to the same people at the Pentagon, Fife and Perle and these other people. And they were rejecting the real intelligence that was coming from the CIA, which was saying a lot of this does not look very good. A lot of this is not very credible. They were rejecting that. And instead, they were looking at the phony evidence coming from this this little group in the Pentagon.
I need to jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me, as I have another person holding, and we're already at our midpoint here. I want to reintroduce our guest. We're talking with James Bamford. He's an investigative reporter. He's written a lot about national security issues. He's written cover stories for the New York Times Magazine, Washington Post Magazine, the LA Times Magazine. He was formerly the Washington investigative reporter for ABC's World News Tonight with Peter Jennings. His new book, if you'd like to read more on the subject in some detail, is titled A Pretext for War, and it's published by Doubleday. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We'll go next to a caller in a nearby community of Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. I have an anecdote and an observation and a small question. The anecdote is I have a close relative that worked for NASA for 20-plus years, NSA, pardon me, and we never, whenever asked who we worked for, we never got an answer, government. It went on for years. After he had retired quite some time, then we found out that that's who we worked for. Kind of tells you a bit about the mindset in that organization. You don't tell anybody whether you're a janitor or the leader or what you are in that organization, even if you work there. The observation, though, is that today the 9/11 Commission came out and said Al-Qaeda and Saddam had no connection. And the first thing our dear leader had to say is, I know better. And why do I know better? Because I know better. Now the question is, where does he get his information?
Well, I think with regard to your first comment, it's a subject I know very well since I've written the only two books on the National Security Agency, NSA. And the old joke was that NSA stood for No Such Agency.
Precisely.
And for the people inside, it stood for Never Say Anything. But with regard to the comments both by Bush and Cheney recently, Cheney made similar comments on Tuesday, that there is a link between, or there has been a link between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. It's been rejected not just by the 911 commission, it's been rejected by the FBI and the CIA. Everybody that's looked at this has rejected it, and the fact that the president could actually come out and still make these claims in face of all the credible rejection of that information just shows either he's totally out of touch with what's really going on in the world, or he's clinging to the last straws that he has on his justification for this war. I mean, he's totally lost all the justification with regard to weapons of mass destruction. Even his own chief weapons inspector, David Kay, came back and said, we all made a mistake. So the only thing he has left is this connection with Al-Qaeda, and that's been taken away from him. So I think he's just ignoring reality and hoping that he's going to, his base, I mean, the people who get virtually 100% of their news from Rush Limbaugh and these other groups, you know, it just is more fodder for them to talk about. They'll ignore the comments of the commission and the FBI and the CIA and just say, well, President Bush said this, and you know, he's basically just appealing to his base there.
Seems to me exactly what he said from the very first day he was quoted, elected. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. On this issue of the quality of intelligence about Iraq, about any kind of Iraq al-Qaeda connection or weapons of mass destruction, it seems that the White House has fairly consistently been saying, we made the best decisions we could based on the information that we were given by CIA and other agencies that whose job it is to conduct that intelligence. Now, the CIA, at least publicly, has been good enough not to contradict the president. But you had the opportunity to talk with a lot of people who were willing to be willing to talk to you, maybe not necessarily on the record, about this issue. So did the White House indeed just make the best out of the intelligence they were given? Or was their reading of that intelligence selective? Or was there some indeed pressure put on the intelligence gatherers to deliver the kind of intelligence that the White House wanted and would allow them to make the case for going to war?
Well, that's it was a combination of those, but it's primarily the fact that they were using very selective intelligence just to back up the claims that they were making. The big tragedy in this, I think, is that George Tenet, who was director of Central Intelligence, had a great opportunity to sort of save the country from a lot of this agony we're going through now, including the war, by resigning back in 2002, and going before Congress making public the fact that the administration is doing this. he was very offended by this, apparently, early on, because what he did was he tried to get the White House to eliminate some of the phony intelligence, including the reports about Saddam Hussein getting uranium from West Africa, from the country of Niger. And he succeeded in getting that removed from the president's speech in Cincinnati in, I think it was October, November of 2002. But it seems like right after that, that's when he caved in, because he never again, apparently, did any kind of heavy objecting to what the administration was saying. And it got so bad that by the time of January 2003, when the president made his State of the Union address, not only did Tenet not get the same information taken out of that speech, incredibly, Tenet even failed to read the speech. I mean, can you imagine the director of Central Intelligence not even reading the president's State of the Union address, a State of the Union address that's going to use intelligence to justify the war that he's about to launch? And Tenet never even bothers to read it. So it seems like in that period, in the fall of 2002, he made a decision either through pressure or just because he wanted to be a team player, not to object and to just go along with whatever the Pentagon, which at that point was supplying a lot of the intelligence, whatever the Pentagon was dishing out.
Well, just a couple of weeks ago, Mr. Tenet resigned. He said that it was for personal reasons, but it didn't seem to be anybody in Washington really believed that. But they seemed to be saying that he was anticipating the fact that there would just be more and more bad news and that he wanted to get out of there before that happened. I suppose some people would say that it was finally he was taking the hit and saying, all right, fine, it was our fault, I'll go. So you think, though, that there was a kind of personal failure of leadership on Mr. Tenet's part?
Well, certainly. He should have resigned a long time earlier. I mean, if nothing else, simply because he's like the captain of the Titanic and he's run into three icebergs by now. It's time to change the command of the ship, and that's the situation he was in. I mean, he was there during 9/11, which was a complete intelligence disaster, and then he was there in the lead up to the Iraq War, which again was another disaster because it was a total intelligence failure, allowing the country to go to war based on wrong intelligence, and then finally, nobody predicted this occupation was going to lead to the crisis we have now. There was plenty of times when he should have resigned simply because he didn't do the job correctly, but I think he should have resigned back in 2002 more in protest than anything else, to protest what he saw, apparently, was the president trying to con the nation into a war based on phony intelligence.
One of the claims that the administration made was that Iraq was interested in building nuclear weapons, and that they made this argument that Iraq had tried to buy uranium from Niger. Sometime after that, a man named Joseph Wilson, who was an ambassador, came out and publicly said, no, this is bunk. The information they have is not correct. It's a clear forgery. There's no indication that happened. And at that point, apparently, the administration decided to attempt to discredit him. And according to him and this book that now he's written recently, in the process of trying to research his background, they stumbled across the fact that his wife was a CIA operative. And that information went to columnist Robert Novak. It was published. And now the story has continued to unfold from there. And at this point, there's an investigation going into who it was that provided Robert Novak with that information about Ambassador Wilson's wife, Valerie Plame, being in the CIA. And he, in his book, points back to the staff of the vice president. I wonder if you have any insight about this and whether in any time soon you think that there's going to be some answer provided to that question of who it is that told Robert Novak that Joe Wilson's wife was in the CIA.
I don't really have any inside information on that. It's just from talking to people and reading what's been done so far, it looks like they may come out this summer with some answer. In the past, traditionally, it's been very difficult to get a positive outcome on an investigation into a leak. But in this case, it may be different because they're really aggressively going after this, and they're interviewing people under oath and I think putting people on lie detectors and things like that. So there's a good chance that they may have an answer in the form of an indictment this summer sometime. And most of the speculation is that it revolves around the little clique of neoconservatives, either in the vice president's office or at the Pentagon someplace. And they were the people who would have, number one, had the knowledge because they would have had access to that kind of information. And number two, they would have had the political motivation to try to discredit Wilson by releasing that information, which was very damaging to his wife's career.
Hmm. Let's go back here to the phones. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah. Part of your title of your book is The Abuse of America's Intelligence Agencies, and Bob Baer, an ex-CIA agent, has been out there. I've heard on talk radios implying that the CIA has often been misused by politicians, and your book is more or less leading up to the Iraq War. But I was wondering if you had anything that might put it into context, you know, in terms of politicians misusing the intelligence agencies.
Yeah, that's a good question. It has been abused in the past. The CIA has been used by politicians over the years to try to get them to give the intelligence that they want, called cooking the books and so forth. It's happened in the past. It happened during the Vietnam War and several other times, but never on this scale, never on the scale where you had basically an alternative intelligence agency forming to take the place of the CIA and to displace the CIA's information. But in this case, it was very blatant. I interviewed people at the CIA, people who didn't want their name revealed, but they told me on background that it was very blatant what was going on there. There was one person I talked to who worked in the section that actually looked for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and they weren't finding anything in terms of hard intelligence. And at one point, the boss of that section came in and called everybody together and said, look, if the president wants to go to war, it's your job to give him a reason to go to war. And at other times, the vice president had come into the CIA and put pressure on people to try to find something. There was constant pressure on them to find things that weren't there. And when they weren't able to find these things, the Pentagon, using these defectors provided by Ahmed Chalabi, came up with the phony information, the information about the mobile weapons lab, for example, and other things that all turned out to be phony in the end. So this was probably the most, I'm certain, having written about intelligence for 25 years, this is certainly the most blatant and abusive misuse of intelligence I've ever seen.
But are you saying that, I got the impression that some of these covert operations that presidents have made the CIA get into. It sounds as if it's a covert black box kind of thing, there's no ethical consideration. But if it's just what is the information, you know, out there, what is the real intelligence data? That's the part that they want to keep sacrosanct. Is that kind of what you're saying? If my question is clear.
Well, I mean, again, just looking back, one of the other key abuses took place during the time of Ronald Reagan, when his director of CIA was Bill Casey, and again, they tried to get around using intelligence because there was a law against the CIA helping the Contras in Nicaragua. So that's why they had Oliver North work for the National Security Council, sort of form his own little intelligence unit and go around the CIA and perform these operations to sort of bypass the law. And that's sort of what's happening in this case, except it's on a much larger scale. Instead of, you know, a lieutenant colonel in the National Security Council, it's the senior officials in the Department of Defense who are creating this separate little intelligence unit to bypass the CIA and provide the intelligence that they wanted to have, intelligence that wasn't real, that was based on imaginary information, and pass it on to the White House and so forth. So that's what I'm saying. I'm saying they're abusing intelligence by bypassing the normal intelligence channels, using the CIA, which was formed to be an impartial arbiter of intelligence, not to politicize it, and instead going to the Pentagon, which was politicizing it and using it to their own advantage.
Well, I guess what I was trying to say is, aren't they inherently politicizing the CIA when they ask them to attempt to assassinate Castro, for example? I mean, that kind of an operation.
Well, that's maybe misusing the CIA, but it's not really politicizing. They're using it. They were using it for to try to accomplish a purpose, using an illegal method at the time, assassination. And they were using it to some degree, you could argue, politicizing it by trying to get it to carry out the president's desires to get rid of Castro. And that's another example, was the Bay of Pigs, when it was heavily politicized. So there have been numerous instances of this in the past, but you know, using it to try to overthrow Castro is one extreme. Using it to launch a war against Iraq is another level of that extreme.
We just have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is James Bamford. He's an investigative reporter. He's written two books about the NSA, National Security Agency, the only books really that exist about the NSA, Body of Secrets and The Puzzle Palace, and has a new book out titled Pretext for War, which takes a look at American intelligence and 9/11, Iraq, terrorism. The book is published by Doubleday. We have some other callers here. We'll go next to Champaign County in line two. Hello.
Hi. I'll try and be fast. We've got about five bullet points here. You're spot on Limbaugh. I tuned in to see what his lead story was, and he's talking about receiving an email from a staffer at the commission saying that they're using one paragraph and they're taking it all out of context about the supposed liaison between al-Qaeda and Saddam regime.
Right, and the frightening thing is there's a vast group of people throughout the country who get 100% of their news that way.
He's playing right to it, exactly. What do you think Tenet's going to do? He was so docile, as you're pointing out, for so long. And this is actually, the host mentioned that the CIA has never publicly contradicted, I guess until yesterday, when a CIA guy was saying, yeah, we agree with the staff report that there's no credible evidence of collusion on the 911, but also it went on and further says that basically Saddam turned down any major collaboration, and it was only with this faction in the Kurdish region that he actually did anything. And there's a lot of stuff floating around about Zakaria, I guess. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
There are people that say he's already dead. And you know, this idea of them killing Berg and wanting to publicly take credit for it with a hood over his head, I mean, if you're publicly taking credit for an assassination like that, don't you, like, pull the hood off and say, well, this really is me? I mean, I think, you know, I don't know what you make of that, but I wanted to comment on the fact that what Tenet might do. Is he going to take a book deal? We're hearing a lot about another book deal, but I wonder whether he'll go to Northrop Grumman and get a high-priced board of directors job, or whether he's going to actually tell what it was like.
I can't imagine that he's not going to do a book at some point. He's got an awful lot to say, and he's got a lot to, you know, he's just got a lot to explain about what went on during that period of time. And I think the best way to do that in a coherent way is not just you know, a 20-minute talk show or something, but writing it in a long book. So I think that will almost certainly be one of his projects. The question, I think, really is whether he's going to come out before the election or after the election in terms of speaking his mind about what went on during his time as Director of Central Intelligence. So I think that's the biggest fear that the administration has. I think the administration was enormously petrified when they found out that Tenet was leaving, because the last two people who left, Paul O'Neill, former Secretary of the Treasury, and Richard Clark, both came out. Richard Clark was a former head of counterterrorism at the White House. Both came out with books extremely critical of Bush, and I think that's one of the things they're very afraid of George Tenet, especially the timing of his leaving. And I think the other thing is that he's one of the few, he's really the only person in the administration who knows where all the bodies are buried, and he's got a number of knife wounds in his back for having been stabbed by this administration. So I think that's extremely worrying to them. He's like a wounded tiger, and they don't know quite what's going to happen.
I wanted to get back to the reaction in Afghanistan. Some of the hearing yesterday was talking again about why didn't we preemptively do something sooner. And you don't hear it much, but the guy that's the ambassador to Afghanistan right now, he's the sort of the viceroy there, is Zalman Khalzad.
Yeah.
And he was working with RAND negotiating, but he was taking money from UNICAL to negotiate with the Taliban in the lead up to all this. So there were a lot of things that the Bush administration was apparently willing to overlook. And I just wanted to know if you had a comment on.
Well, they did. There was a fair amount of activity between the administration and Afghanistan prior to the September 11th attack. The administration had authorized quite a bit of money to be paid to the Taliban on the drug war to get them to halt their activity during the in terms of growing poppies and so forth. So there was a lot of money that went to them, and there was a fair amount of negotiations that went on between a number of companies and the involvement of the U.S. government to some degree in the whole idea of this oil pipeline across Afghanistan. So they certainly weren't treating them as states they were about to invade or anything in the days leading up to September 11th. They weren't, you know, treating them, you know, as a favored nation or anything, but it was far from treating them like North Korea.
We're just about the point where we have to finish. I just want to ask you real quick, and this is another question, and I'm not sure if you have information on this, but I guess I'm interested in what's going on with Mr. Chalabi, the man who was the leader of the Iraqi National Congress and was very close to people in the Department of Defense, provided a lot of information to them about Iraq, which turned out to be wrong, and now just a couple of weeks ago was accused of providing secret information, intelligence information that he gleaned from someone in the government to the government of Iran, something that he denied. He does have a little bit of a shady background. He is, if I'm remembering correctly, actually wanted for bank fraud in Jordan. He's a fugitive from justice in Jordan. So there's some questions about his character. Do you have any information about this supposed information that he passed on to the Iranians?
Well, actually, in my book, I focus quite a bit on Ahmed Chalabi and his background, how he became friends with the neoconservatives back in the 80s and all through the 90s. They were grooming him to be the successor to Saddam Hussein. He was dealt with by the CIA in the early 90s as a potential opponent of Saddam Hussein, and he was given money. And and support, but that all ended in the mid-1990s because they found out that they couldn't trust him. They couldn't trust the information he was giving, and they couldn't trust him with the money they were giving to him. So around the mid-1990s, I think both the CIA and the State Department broke off any kind of contact with him. But he was the darling of these neoconservatives, and when the Bush administration took office, he became sort of the heir apparent in Iraq, and he took this place of honor. There are very few people that get to sit in the president's gallery right behind the first lady during the president's State of the Union address, and that's where Ahmed Chalabi was sitting. So these people overlooked the fact that he was basically a fraud and a con man all his most of his adult life, including that bank fraud conviction in Jordan, and went ahead full steam with trying to use his information and put him in power, and now it's all hitting them in the face. Yeah, the
I'm sorry, I'm gonna have to jump in you on this point, having asked the question and not given you enough time to answer, because I'm at the end of the time and I've got to stop. I just have enough time to say, Mr. Bamford, thanks very much, and we really appreciate you talking with us today.
Well, it was a great show, and thanks for having me on.
Our guest, James Bamford, he's an investigative reporter. His book is titled A Pretext for War. It's out now. It's published by Doubleday.